Hey, ladies and gentlemen, first case for argument, Emerald Investments v. Allmerica. Mr. Gilbert.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alan Gilbert here on behalf of the defendant below, Allmerica Financial Life Insurance and Annuity Company. We are here seeking reversal of the damages verdict entered for plaintiff after a jury trial on damages alone. And let me make it clear, Allmerica only seeks a reversal. Allmerica is not seeking a new trial on damages if the court were to determine, based on the points Allmerica raises, that that might be an appropriate remedy. The first point and reason why the verdict should be reversed as a matter of law is that Emerald did not meet its burden of showing that the damages that it was awarded were foreseeable. Under Hadley v. Baxendale, these were not foreseeable damages.
Now, I don't understand your invocation of Hadley. So Hadley is really a special handling case, right? So Hadley hired Baxendale to transport its mill shaft and didn't tell it that it didn't have a spare and therefore its mill would be shut down. So Baxendale didn't take special precautions, you know, and Hadley lost mill profits. And Hadley should have told Baxendale that, you know, it didn't have a spare, they'd have to take special care, and undoubtedly Baxendale would have charged some premium to insure it. I don't see that this case is at all similar. This is just a case where the person, Emerald, sees a profit opportunity. It's not going to tell the other party to the contract about the profit opportunity. Then you'd use it, right? You'd take it. You do the arbitrage. So I don't see it as a Hadley case.
Your Honor, as Hadley's been interpreted by the Illinois courts, certainly the facts are different from Hadley itself. But the principles.
In fact, it's the whole situation. It's not as if Hadley had been reluctant to tell Baxendale that it had no spare because it was afraid that Baxendale might go into the milling business, take advantage of its mill being closed. You don't have to disclose your business plan to the other party to a contract.
No, but Your Honor, it's not. This is just a two-person contract here. These are annuities that were sold in the market. These are investment vehicles that are sold.
And you permit the investor to switch between the domestic and the international account, and they saw an opportunity to make money doing that, arbitraging, which is a respectable way of making money in our culture.
That is true, Your Honor. But what was not a reasonable expectation at the time and what could not have been contemplated was the extraordinary profits and the nature of the trading strategy that they were engaged in.
I don't understand that because people go into business in the hope of making extraordinary profits. You don't go up to a person you want to make a deal with and say, look, we want to enter into a contract with you because we want to make extraordinary profits. Then the other side would say, well, wow, extraordinary profits. Maybe I can get some of those profits.
Your Honor, that would work in a two-party situation, perhaps. And an example is the Backowitz case, which is in the Backowitz case, which is a case out of the Illinois courts. There was someone who was selling an apartment building to Mr. Backowitz. Mr. Backowitz said, I'm going to take that apartment building and I'm going to convert it into condominiums. And when the seller breached the contract, Mr. Backowitz said, I would like to get lost profits for what's going to happen with those condominiums. I entered into this contract to make a profit. And the court said, no. That's a different situation. Those profits didn't come out of this contract itself. Just because you told them you were planning to make a profit and you might make a profit and it would be expected you'd make a profit through the conversion of those condominiums, that's not a reason that the seller has to be responsible for that. similarly here, and I think a fortiori here.
I don't understand you. You enter into a contract. So a case that I think is more applicable, famous case, Laidlaw versus, well, I forgot the last name, where someone learned about the Treaty of Ghent that ended the War of 1812 before anybody else knew, and realized that the price of cotton would rise. And so he, you know, bought a whole lot of cotton from the defendant, Orgain. And the defendant said, gee, I would never have sold that cotton if I'd known what the buyer knew, that the buyer was going to, there were immense profits to be made because with the end of the war, you know, cotton could be exported again. And the court said, no. I mean, of course, you don't disclose. You know, suppose you find you buy a painting in a some kind of from a pawn shop, and you recognize it is extremely valuable, and the pawn shop owner doesn't. You don't tell him that. You don't tell him about your superior knowledge. And similarly, the fact that you guys had not spotted this arbitrage opportunity was no reason for Emerald to tell you about it.
Your Honor, those situations are different in that there you're talking about whether the deal itself should have occurred. Here, what we're talking about is whether someone who issues financial products is going to be responsible for the trading strategies of the buyers.
I mean, I thought, in a sense, maybe just to focus this a little differently, your argument was more about the measure of the future lost profits damages, because you've conceded breach, as far as I understand.
We're not appealing the court's ruling of breach.
Okay,
that's correct.
So you've conceded that there's a breach, and you've paid, you know, a certain amount of money, the $150,000. But there's often an issue about measuring profits in the future, whether it's in an antitrust case where somebody's talking about a lost market opportunity, or whether it's in this kind of case where somebody says, gee, you know, between the year 2000, pick your year, 2001, 2002, and 2015, we would have made 35% a year profit. I mean, there's a question of how are those damages measured.
Yes, you are, and that is what this case is what
future
profits they're entitled to.
It's a different argument than the one you've
Well, that argument
your first
is
argument
there.
Is that you don't owe any damages at all, and your second argument is that they were wrongly computed.
The second argument is that they were so speculative, given the nature of what they had to do to make these profits and what was going on in the markets, that as a matter of law, they shouldn't have been awarded. Their appeal deals with some of the computation.
Measurement difficulties and foreseeability are two different issues. Right?
Yeah.
You could foresee that there might be unusual profits here, and yet it might be impossible for the plaintiff to prove them because of.
Your Honor, there was no way to foresee the unusual profits, and that's what the foreseeability argument here is about.
That an investor could make a lot of money, but I thought your second argument was that they have not been able to quantify those damages.
That's what I thought it was too, and also that's why you wanted to look at what was happening in the market as the early 2000 years were passing by. What might have been a 40% rate of return in the late 90s was turning into a 10% or even a flat or negative rate of return.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And with regard to that argument, they did not quantify, as they could have, the damages here. And let me just make two points on that in addition to what's in our briefs, which is, one, that they knew how to make contemporaneous records during the damage period of how they might have traded, when they might have traded during that time, even though they couldn't within our contract. There was evidence at the trial that in another situation where they had similarly been prevented from doing what they wanted to do, they had kept contemporaneous records on a daily basis of when they were trading, which would have been better evidence, at least, of what they could have done and what they might have done during that period. Number two, they presented no evidence at trial of what their returns were using this strategy during the damage period. They based their evidence at trial solely upon their returns prior to the date of breach, which was December of 2001.
Now, when you refer to the damage period, are you referring to the period that they are contesting that gets shut off on July 9, 2004?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Because they argue that that shouldn't have been an endpoint also.
Yes, that's correct. But they presented no evidence, even up to the date of trial in 2006, of what their returns were using this strategy during that period from 2001 forward. Doesn't matter whether it was during the damage period or even up to trial, even though they presumably could have presented such evidence.
Was there any other expert testimony for the plaintiff's damages claim after Dr. Busey's testimony was excluded, or was
no,
the entire damages case rested on Mr. Rubin's testimony?
It rested on Mr. Rubin. That was the they did not provide another expert.
And was his testimony, he's this Emerald executive, apparently, right?
Yes, he was the person who was trading for Emerald during that period.
And was his testimony all hindsight-based, I gather?
Yes, it was all hindsight-based. What he said is, during this damage period, I looked and decided I, in hindsight, would have traded during these particular days. And the evidence came out at trial that he could have and did in another situation keep contemporaneous records with sending a fax, an email, some notice to their attorneys every day they would have traded. So there could have been a way they could have done this with contemporaneous records, which they did not do.
Did you have some expert testimony to refute that or point out the flaws in that
measure?
Yes, we did.
Dr. Andrew Caron, an expert economist, testified and pointed out the problems with Mr. Rubin's damage model. Given that the time we've taken on foreseeability, I want to speak a little bit about the points that have been raised by Emerald in their appeal. First of all, the essence of their appeal is that they're trying to recover in this lawsuit's profits they would not have been able to recover in the real world. Judge Grady got it right to limit the damages that they could recover based upon what happened in the real world prior to trial and what was likely to happen in the real world.
Something you said a little while ago struck me. So are you saying that after December 2001 they continued to do this trading, this arbitraging with other...
Yes, to some limited extent.
So you're saying that would be the natural benchmark, how they did with other...
That would be one benchmark. The best we could do is we were able to get their overall returns during that period, which turned out to be declining. In fact, they lost money in 2003, and they lost money during the first 6 months of 2004, or 7 months, during the end of the damage period there. But they did not break out, as is their obligation under the Movitz case, under the Midland case, to show that there weren't other, to break out what damages were caused by the breacher.
Is there still an arbitrage opportunity with these domestic and international, or have you or someone else adopted a different method of pricing?
Fair value pricing is in place, to my knowledge, virtually everywhere at this point. The SEC has required it to be put in place. In fact, in a decision which I know Judge Sykes is familiar with, since she wrote a decision, DH2, the plaintiffs here, DH2 being the managing partner of Emerald, sued the SEC to try to stop that, which in itself is a recognition of how fair value pricing could stop that. And that was something that was presented at trial, and our expert, Dr. Caron, presented that and showed how fair value pricing would have stopped them from being able to recover.
I actually thought that was part of the theory here, that they couldn't really exit your fund and then just go to some different fund that would allow them to pursue the time trading strategy, since it was drying up in the market.
That certainly was their theory. They knew that when they came into our fund. We didn't know that when they came into the fund, and that certainly was not something foreseeable to my client at the time that there would not be other funds available to them, foreseeable at the time of contracting. And indeed, the restatement, and I think it's comment D to Section 351, actually talks about that as being one of the factors in foreseeability.
That use of foreseeability bothers me, because when you sign a contract, there are a zillion contingencies that may surprise one of the parties, and the whole purpose of going into a contract is to secure yourself against those future vicissitudes. So the fact that you can't foresee what is going to happen to other funds,
I'm getting into my rebuttal time here, but just a couple additional points on Emerald's appeal. In terms of the fund cutoff in July 2004, there was no expectation on Emerald's part that any funds would be available during the life of the annuities. The language of the annuities themselves says that Allmerica can add, delete, eliminate investments, and that's what Judge Grady found, and he found that properly, and that's certainly set forth in full in our brief. In terms of the Dr. Buser, his failure to take into account what had happened post-breach, pre-trial, in the real world was fatal to both of his opinions, and I would direct the court to Justice Cardozo's statement in Sinclair Refining, which is actually in the Franconia case, which is cited by the plaintiffs in their reply. That's at page 756, footnote 67, where Justice Cardozo talks about the need to look at the real world to determine the truth of any foresight view of what profits might be lost. And finally, on the Scudder point, it was the plaintiffs who limited their damages to the trading that would occur within the Scudder fund. That was the basis of their damage theory. That was the only fund that they had traded in while they were when they were able to trade in the All-America annuities, and they voluntarily limited it to Scudder. The court was right in finding, consistent with the Movitz case of Your Honor, the Midland case of the Illinois Supreme Court, that the burden is on the plaintiff as part of its cause determination, is proving proximate cause and proving cause, to show that there were not other factors that could have led to the injuries that were involved here. And that was what Judge Grady was doing by saying that they had to show that Scudder would have allowed these trades to have been made.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Mr. Bergen?
May it please the court, Charles Bergen for the Appellee, American National Bank as trustee for the benefit of Emerald Investments and Emerald Investments LP. Let me first say that Emerald, our theme is Emerald, like any other party seeking damages for breach of contract, is entitled to the benefit of its bargain.
But how much of the benefit of the bargain are you asking for? Because it seemed to me you are making the assumption that you would have, from the time this contract was entered until the end, 2015-2020, continued to earn a 35% per year rate of return, which does not seem remotely likely to me, at least looking at the history of markets.
I would say that is the outside possibility, but that's not what the issue is here. And I share your skepticism. There's a whole host of issues about whether we can prove that, whether it's too speculative, how far out it goes. But let me take it in pieces.
But that seems almost as a matter of law too speculative.
It's
to me.
A long time, and I'm not going to fight you on that point.
Okay.
But it's particularly preposterous when you're talking about arbitrage.
Well,
because the essence of an arbitrage opportunity is that it is a fleeting and temporary opportunity, right? Arbitrage means there are two identical products that are being sold in different places for different prices. And even though there's no transportation cost or other reason for the difference, it's just lack of information. And the arbitrager observes this arbitrary differential, buys the lower price, sells at the higher. That eliminates the difference. That's the social purpose of arbitrage. It eliminates the difference. So a specific arbitrage opportunity has to be extremely temporary. In fact, it's very surprising that you were able to do this for as long as you did before people woke up and said, you know, this is a completely arbitrary difference. We have to reprice these investments so that we eliminate that really loophole that you were running through.
Let me address that in two parts. The first part is, this isn't really pure arbitrage, and I'm proceeding with caution telling you anything about economics, Your Honor, but this is more of an inefficient pricing mechanism that could lead to losses and could lead to profits.
No, arbitrage is risky. Arbitrage is risky. And you had this overnight risk, but at an expected value basis, you were bound to do well, you know, on average until they woke up and repriced these investments.
Second point I wanted to make.
Which they did. They woke up, right? They eliminated.
Well, and no, they didn't. Let me take the second point, and then I'll come back to that. The second point is, this is like a long-term lease. This was a long-term product that we could not get out of for a minimum of 7 years. So Judge Wood was asking about the length of time. It would have been at least 7 years before Emerald could voluntarily have left this product. It was a long-term commitment on both sides. We had the option of going beyond the 7 years, but we were locked in for seven, or else we had to pay a penalty. That's the first thing. The second thing is, like a long-term lease, you can always say there's some arbitrage. You bought on the Near West Side when it was not very nice. Now it's very nice.
No, that's not arbitrage. That's a change in value over time. Arbitrage is where simultaneously you have the same thing being sold at two different prices.
And here's the thing.
So just to back off, I mean, you are trying to compare your decision to participate in Allmerica's funds with, you know, or its variable annuities or whatever, with the individual trading strategies that you have inside the fund. That's where you were taking advantage of the arbitrage. And so you're trying to say, you know, like if your long-term lease had some internal trading going on, maybe that would be something. But
sure. I mean,
it's not the same at all. They were more than willing to let you stay in the fund. You just couldn't handle your internal transactions in the same way.
They would not let us stay in the funds that we told them at the outset. In March of 1999, we want to do two things. We want to trade a couple round trips a month, and we want to go between the money market and the international funds.
But they had reserved the right to change the subcontracts.
No, I think that's an error of law. For example, if they wanted to reserve that right in the 1993 contract, the immediate predecessor, they specifically say the owner may transfer amounts between the general account and the subaccounts subject to the consent of the company. It says minimum and maximum amounts may apply. And it says, in addition, the company reserves the right to limit the number of transfers.
Well, but I'm not talking about limiting transfers. I understand the contract, which has a section on addition, deletions, or substitution of investments, as reserving the right to change the investment vehicles that are inside this contract.
That's correct.
And that's what they eventually did.
What they did was not to change them. They didn't close any investments.
They said no new money will go into the international.
They said you may not transfer into it. Now, to the
right,
extent,
which is what I just said. No new money goes into, and that's a change.
And that is directly contradictory to the point in the contract where it says transfers at page 10 with bold letters. And it says you may transfer there as by written or telephone request. No charge for the first 12, a transfer of $25.
You could have transferred 500 times among other subcontracts that they had. You just didn't want to.
No, we were entitled to transfer among any of the accounts in the contract. They went in 2004, after summary judgment was entered against them, and tried to jimmy it up. They kept the account
open.
Well, they
shut it down for everybody. They didn't just shut it down for Emerald.
They did not shut it down for
the new money part.
They shut it down to new money. That's correct.
They created a restriction on new money going in, and it wasn't just Emerald.
That's correct.
It was the world.
And the other question that raises, of course, is whether 3 years after the breach and after judgment had been entered against them, whether Judge Grady was correct in deciding, as a matter of law, that there was a partial breach situation where they could still rely on the contract to minimize their damages.
But this, of course, wasn't a contract only with you. You weren't the only company who held
yes. We were, as far as there's no evidence that anybody else had. There may have been other policyholders, but we're not aware of any. There's no record evidence that there were. We don't know. There's no others in the record.
So
besides
you were America's only customer?
For this policy, there is Gateway Custom, there's Gateway Select, there's Gateway Advisor, there's Gateway Plus. We don't know. We asked who were the other customers were. We didn't get that discovery. There may be other customers. I wouldn't be surprised if there were other customers, Judge. There's no record evidence of any other customers.
So you were awarded $1 million in damages, roughly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So what is that based on? I mean, what would be the reasoning process or the evidence that would lead to that award?
I think it's based on the improper instruction that Judge Grady gave, limiting damages to those trades that Scudder would have approved.
Because Scudder was about to go dark on this whole thing, according to the note they sent in June.
Yeah, but Scudder said, when they looked at their own policies in their internal memoranda, Scudder agreed that they had no power to do that. Scudder said, we'd hate to go dark, and they bullied. But when the director of Scudder was deposed, Becton, and he was asked, what did you do? What were you prepared to do? He said, I don't know. I can't say. It would be speculative. And let me point you to the participation agreement. In the participation agreement, which governs the relationship between Allmerica and Scudder, that agreement says that all Scudder can do is request cooperation. I'm looking specifically at Section 5.4 of the 2002 Participation Agreement. And that paragraph says the company, meaning their Allmerica, agrees to cooperate with the fund, the underwriter, and the advisor. Those are various Scudder entities. With a view to exercising rights reserved by the company under the terms of the contracts, if any, if Allmerica reserved any rights, to limit transfers to the extent reasonably requested by the fund, the underwriter, the advisor, if such party reasonably believes that certain contract owners are engaged in short-term trading to the degree that such trading interferes with the orderly management of the designated portfolios.
Right, but
at a minimum,
cutting to the chase, though, are you saying that it would be impossible for Scudder just to stop doing business with Allmerica?
They could stop doing business with Allmerica. And Allmerica, remember, our relationship.
So the short answer is yes. Stop doing, okay.
They could. They said they wouldn't want to. They said it would be a dark day.
Yeah, no, I understand that. You don't walk away
from that much business.
Profitable business. But they could have done so if they had had.
But our contract is with Allmerica. And what Allmerica couldn't do was deny us. We're in the subaccounts. They agree they will transfer our money among subaccounts. And they agree we will get the prices. They figure out the prices. You know, we talked about this arbitrage opportunity.
But it's just an issue whether Scudder would have pulled the plug, right? That's just an issue of causation. My question about the $1 million was actually different. You're of course concerned it's too little. I'm concerned maybe it's too much. What is the evidence that would actually justify any recovery of damages?
Contrary to what Mr. Gilbert said, Plaintiff's Exhibit 9 was an account ledger from Emerald. And that's at the EA 471 and following in the appendix. And that shows every trade that was made during the time period from 1198 to 11604 in these accounts. We also supplied them with Emerald Variable Annuity Round Trips. I don't have the exhibit number, but it begins at EA 507, also in evidence. And this shows every trade, not just with Scudder entities, but with every entity. And what Mr. Rubin did, and Mr. Rubin is an MBA. He was the former head of trading for a large Wall Street concern. He's worked at what is now Chase and First Chicago here in trading operations. He is very well versed in these. These are the trades he made, and this is what he relied on in determining if I traded foreign funds in other accounts, in the accounts that were honoring their contracts during this period.
This is what I relied on. So in December, right, December 2001, that's when you were cut off by America. Okay. And then but you continue doing other trading with other companies, so that's fine.
Correct.
But now you have to show that money you were trading in America, you would have invested with these other funds or something like that. And, let me put this way. What happened to that money that you had been trading with? What did you do with it?
That period of time, there was very little other excess capacity. That's what made these rights and these contracts, these long-term rights, so valuable.
What do you mean, excess capacity?
We had more capital. My client had more capital to deploy than it could deploy. And part of this was because...
So you put it in a CD? I mean, what did you do with the money?
I think they returned it to the bank, and they paid down loans they might have had from the bank to finance the strategy, and then it really sat there in a period when money market rates were low. Mr. Gilbert suggested our overall returns went down. One of the reasons was that in retail mutual funds, which are different than variable annuities in that each purchase and sale is a separate transaction, the retail funds had decided in about 2000 that they were not going to permit any more of this trading. And as was within their rights under their contracts, they said no more. And so that led to this excess capacity. It made the longer-term contracts, it made the contracts like this variable annuity, like the Equitable variable annuity, that much more valuable because under those contracts, we paid significant fees to receive a significant benefit, a long-term agreement that we could trade among sub-accounts, that we could transfer among sub-accounts. Our people were so concerned that before entering into the contract, they sent letters and said, this is exactly what we want to do.
Suppose you have all these rights to trade among sub-accounts, but something else happens in the market, you know, an SEC regulation or something that changes the pricing structure in the market as a whole such that the arbitrage opportunity that caused you to want to trade like that goes away.
That, and to some extent, that's something that the jury would decide based on evidence if we were permitted to get beyond the question of what would Scudder do. As Judge Sykes knows, the SEC was very involved in creating something called fair value pricing where they attempt to make pricing more efficient. It's not impossible to do. I mean, it's funny to think that two guys out in Northbrook can price this better than a large financial organization run by Goldman Sachs. Fair value pricing has come in, and during the period of time when we looked at it, Scudder began it in January of 2004, so during the damages period, we looked at some fair value price traded. We still made money. And Professor Bucer, in his report, said the returns, even with fair value pricing, went down from about 35% to about 28%. That's still a very good return.
I thought Professor Bucer's reports, though, were not terribly helpful. They seemed to assume, I mean, they were based on such a small time period and such a distorted time period, really. I wasn't too impressed with them.
I think is he the one who started off by projecting 20 years or 27 years of profits?
He did a projection that went for the full life of the contracts.
If someone does that, he shouldn't be permitted to testify in this or any other case. That's completely irresponsible.
Your Honor, he looked at the life of the contract. It would be clear, I think, to most of us that...
A person not using his economic training or his common sense.
Well, I would have to ask the court whether or not it's a jury question, at least instance.
I don't think he should have been permitted to testify.
I think at a minimum he should have been permitted to testify.
No, I don't think so. Not after what he did initially.
We differ on that.
Far beyond the limits of reasonable advocacy on the part of an expert witness.
That may be. We're just going to disagree on that, I think. In terms of Bucer's other testimony with the academic studies, these were peer-reviewed studies. These were studies that had been performed at a variety of institutions. These were studies that showed a persistent long-term return from this strategy, and these studies should have been allowed in. A number of those were done during the time period that we were trading. Some of them were done after. And so I think those should have come in.
Well, none of them said it was going to last for 20 years.
Well, I think what we should have been allowed to do, maybe not 20 years.
But make 35% a year for 20 years?
That's ridiculous. That would be extraordinary.
That's ridiculous. But why didn't Bucer look at these academic studies before his first report?
I believe he did, and he mentioned them in his first report, but I'd have to check the record on that.
And he thought they supported a 20-year projection of a 35% annual return?
And in the 20-year projection, Your Honor. The 7-year period for these contracts that we were locked in began in 1999.
Compound
Oh, it's huge.
Profit for 35% for 20 years, you're going to have trillions. You're going to be in the trillions.
Well, actually what Bucer did, Judge, is he limited the growth over time. He looked at historical fund growth of 10% per year, and he put a cap on that, assuming the funds wouldn't grow faster than they would. Otherwise, the lily pad would exceed the
bond. What was his initial estimate of damages in his first report?
I should know this, and I don't. I believe it was about $110 million. Over the 20 years. That's a large number, no question. But that was an initial report. We all know when you get to trial, you pick evidence that...
No, I don't buy that.
All right.
You can't hire an economic expert and tell him to do nonsense. And he says, fine, that's what you want me to do. Yeah, I'll project from now to the year 1 million. No, I think that's abdicating his professional responsibility.
From the outset... I understand your position on that, and I'd like to go on. We had three legs, and any one of which we saw as independent, to establish damages. The first leg were the academic studies, the peer-reviewed articles. Those show a persistent rate of 35% in a variety of different markets. The second that we had was Mr. Rubin's own trading. His numbers were not...
persistent 35%, and what would be an example of such a study?
The Baragava study from 1998.
What was that about?
They looked at short-term trading in international funds and found that because of the pricing inefficiency that was then built into the system, the rate of return would be, using a very simple binary strategy, around 35%.
Over what period?
I think that was about a 2.5 or 3 year period. Mm-hmm. Other studies, Zitzowitz came out in 2000. He reported a similar result.
Over what period?
Yeah, right.
Again, 3 or 4 year period.
How could Bucer think that this could be extrapolated to 20 years?
David Hoken, the founder of Emerald, began this strategy in 1998. He started trading with this strategy in 1998. His profits from the time he founded Emerald in 1991 to the time of the breach were on the order of 40% per annum. It was a very successful strategy through good markets and bad, through ups and downs, over a long period of time. So, I see my yellow light's on. In sum, it's our belief that the trial court erred by creating the Scudder defense by itself and inserting the issue of Scudder into this case. This contract was between Emerald and Allmerica only. Second, the court erred by deciding disputed issues of fact, such as partial breach, in the course of deciding to limit our damages period to July 2004. Third, he impermissibly interfered with Emerald's ability to present to the jury reasonable estimates of Emerald's policies, of the value of Emerald's policies, based on the studies, the peer-reviewed studies, based on Rubin's analysis of his actual trading and other accounts, and based on the benchmarks that were set historically from the time the strategy began, about 10 years till then.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Bergen. Mr. Gilbert, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Just a few points, Your Honor. One, I'm going to return to foreseeability. Mr. Bergen mentioned that they were locked in for 7 years to this contract. They weren't locked in. What's foreseeable is that persons who don't like what's going on in that contract can take that money out and invested elsewhere. Sure, there was a surrender fee that was charged. They were charged $150,000. The court found that was a foreseeable damage. That is the foreseeable damage that they were entitled to, and they've been paid that fee. We are not appealing that fee. The damages they're seeking are not ordinary course damages, ordinary course being the term that's used in the Hadley line of cases. And annuities are retirement vehicles. Someone who's issuing these retirement vehicles is not issuing them for traders, and in the ordinary course would not expect to pay those trading damages.
That may be true in general, but that wasn't the intent on either side behind this particular annuity contract, was it?
Well,
Everybody knew that this wasn't a retirement vehicle.
There was nothing that our client knew regarding anything about the extraordinary profits or the trading that they were engaged in.
Did you know nothing about Emerald Investments?
No.
I thought that there was some woman named Natalie Sternberg, and yet she was the supposed annuitant, but the beneficiary in the contract was Emerald. So you
That's
knew
correct.
Emerald was was in there for the money.
Yeah, basically. But didn't know anything about the trading strategy they were engaged in or the extraordinary profits they were seeking, and that's what's missing
but
here.
You knew that there weren't just widows and orphans, you know. That this was some kind of financial company. You know, they're always looking for profit opportunities.
And going down the line in the limited time I have here, first, in terms of this notion that there weren't any other policyholders in this contract, that's not true. In the record, there is an affidavit of Michael Reardon explaining why the funds were closed, and he mentions in there that there's a copy, and this is at docket number 127. It's in the box of sealed items. It's attached to All America's 11-804, November 8-04 memorandum on this point. There's a printed notice that went out to various contract holders, and there's discussion about how one contract holder, in this instance, had brought this lawsuit, which prevented the means of stopping timing from occurring, and that there was a need for the contracts as a whole to issue the to stop the new investment.
Could you just take a minute to explain the doctrine of partial breach, which I confess to never having heard of before?
I believe it's been a little misused by Emerald. All that meant in the context of this case is that Emerald, at the time of the breach, had a right to either continue in the contract or to say the contract's over, we're going to take all our money out and leave. And by partial breach, and there are a number of cases that talk about this, when you have that option, you can go forward. But if you go forward in that situation, then that leaves the other party available to use the other terms of the contract. That's all we're talking about there. Just a couple little points to clarify. The second Boozer report, to the extent that was being presented solely for the purpose of providing those academic articles, that's harmless error here in that the evidence was presented to the jury, and this is in our brief, and it was argued at final argument by Mr. Bergen. So number one, it shouldn't have gotten in the first place, but it did, and so there's no harm there. By the way, in his first report, I believe Mr. Buser actually calculated about $150 million, not $110 million in damages. Final point is this discussion about letters being sent. Number one, the letter that they rely on was not admitted below. They have not challenged the failure to admit that here, so they can't rely on it. But it does point up that they could have sent a letter saying, for instance, we're entering into this contract to trade between the international funds and other funds. We want you to assure us that international funds will be available during the life of this contract. We want to tell you that you're going to be responsible, given our trading strategy, for losses that might occur if you were to in any way breach your obligations under the contract or under this letter. They made no such attempt. The letter they sent just dealt with ability to transfer, and that letter was not even signed, so they have no real expectation based on that. And unless the court has...